Biblical Sexual Ethics and a Biblical Theory of Sex, the sixth talk in a series titled Ethics of Sex in the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 4, 2014, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 2, Biblical Sexual Ethics and a Biblical Theory of Sex, accompanies this talk.
All right, we're just going to have one more session and then call it good for the spring. So what I want to do is to move on to part 2 in my notes, which is Biblical Sexual Ethics and the Biblical Theory of Sex. And I'm going to argue that really ultimately everything that we judge to be right or wrong with respect to human sexuality in the Bible is using a certain theory of sex as the touchstone. So this may be more than I can cover in one session. I'm going to do my best to try to cover it, but I may have to kind of just hit the highlights along the way. And maybe sometime in the future we can come back and do it at a more leisurely pace. But for now, I'm going to do my best just to get through the material. The key to understanding a biblical theory of sex, it seems to me, is understanding the relationship between marriage and sex in the Bible. So my first point there, marriage and sexual ethics in the Bible. One cannot understand biblical sexual ethics without understanding the biblical concept of marriage and the Bible's understanding of the relationship between sex and marriage. That's key to understanding what the Bible has to teach us about sexual ethics. In the Bible, no act of sexual intimacy is righteous if it is not within the context of marriage. If one understands why this is so, then he is in a position to understand much of what the Bible teaches with regard to sexual ethics, but not everything. I mean, just because it is in the context of marriage, I'm going to argue, does not make it righteous, does not make it ethical or right. But if it's not within the context of marriage, then ipso facto, it is already not righteous and not right. So we have to understand that in order to understand even where to begin with biblical sexual ethics. So we'll look first at marriage in order to understand sex. And the reason for that priority is because of how the Bible looks at the relationship between sex and marriage. Notice that's exactly the opposite of the way our culture looks at it. The culture would look at animal sexuality that evolved is the given. And what is marriage? It's a human institution that human beings invented to be able to control and guide and govern and channel our sexuality. But it's really us doing it, us human beings figuring out a way to manage our sexuality. And what follows from that is if we come up with a better idea, then we can change it. We can change what marriage is, we can change how we look at marriage, we can change the characteristics of marriage, because we invented it to start with, so why can't we reinvent it? From the biblical perspective, God has defined marriage in the Bible. He had in mind a particular unique kind of relationship that we call marriage, and he created us with human sexuality, and I'm making a distinction between human sexuality and animal sexuality, and created human sexuality to serve the purposes of that unique relationship called marriage. So it's exactly the opposite perspective from what prevails out there in our culture. So we start not with sex, but with marriage. I think we have a definition of marriage in Genesis 2:24. We have the creation of Eve in Genesis 2. The Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man and brought her to the man. The man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." And then now what I think is a definition. "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." But a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now, there's two reasons why I take this as the definition of marriage, and two reasons why I take this as absolutely paradigmatic for all marriages. One is just the nature of the opening chapter of Genesis. It is a really profound few chapters, I think, because the opening chapters of Genesis give us all kinds of paradigms. The transgression of Adam and Eve is a paradigm for the transgression of every one of us. Who they are, what they did, why they did it is just me writ large in the opening chapters of Genesis. So I understand sin by understanding the opening chapters of Genesis. Similarly, I understand marriage by understanding what marriage is said to be in the opening chapters of Genesis. Adam and Eve is not just one man, particular man married to one particular woman. It's the human male in relationship to the human female. I think that's what it's intended to teach us. Then if we go to chapter 19 of Matthew, we have out of Jesus' own mouth, the question is, I'll start with verse 3 of 19. Some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Then they ask him, so why did Moses issue a certificate of divorce? And he basically says, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. Okay, but for our purposes, the important thing is the way he looks at Genesis. He looks at Genesis as the relationship between Adam and Eve is a paradigm for every marriage, the relationship of a man and a woman in marriage. So that's how he's looking at Genesis. Well, let me look at it that way then, and I'm suggesting that we have basically the definition of marriage in 224, and it's composed of two elements. Well, it's one thing with two aspects to it. What is it? It's a moral commitment of a man to a woman and a woman to a man. Now, we're going to notice here that he is defining it from the perspective of the man, but I think what makes the most sense is that it's a mutual relationship. So everything that you could say about the nature of the commitment of the husband to his wife is equally true of the commitment of the wife to her husband. So I think it's completely symmetrical and completely mutual. But we're going to get the wording from the standpoint of what the man is doing in relationship to his wife. It's fundamentally a moral commitment, and I'll talk more about that in a second. Again, unlike so much of modern society, we don't get married because we love each other in the sense of romantic love, as that has become the myth of our culture. It's not about romantic love. It's about a moral commitment, and what I mean by a moral commitment, a commitment to which I am morally obligated. I carry through with the commitment because it would be immoral not to. So it's really a commitment first and foremost to my Creator, as all moral commitments are. I have a commitment before God to follow through on the promises that I've made to another human being. That's what I mean by a moral commitment. Well, marriage is that. That's what marriage is a moral commitment. And it's a moral commitment involving two promises. To leave father and mother and cleave to one's wife, and to become one flesh. Okay, now what does that mean? What's really fascinating here is that this is ancient literature, this account in Genesis. And yet, it describes the man leaving his family to be joined to his wife and not the other way around. I mean, even when you look at the practices in the Old Testament, it's the woman who leaves her family, not the man. But yet when the definition is given here right in Genesis, the statement is to the man will leave his father and mother in order to cleave to his wife. I take it that what that means is And we have, this is hard for us moderns, where the family has become so relatively unimportant to us. But throughout most of human history, family was everything. That's what defined you. Those were your built-in relationships. That was your safety. The family was on your side, and you could count on the family. With the breakdown of the family, we don't think that's such a big deal to leave father and mother and leave your family. But in the ancient world, that would have been huge. So to suggest to a man, you need to leave your father and mother in order to cleave to your wife, is basically to say, you're promising to place your loyalty to this woman higher than the highest human loyalty you know. Your loyalty to your family, especially your loyalty to your father and mother. So you are forsaking them, in a sense. You are forsaking that loyalty that you have to them for the sake of building and acting on and following through on a higher loyalty that you are going to extend to this woman. And as I said, then, I think this is supposed to be mutual. The woman leaves her father and mother in order to cleave to her husband. So they are mutually saying, you're going to become the most important person in my life. I'm going to do everything and decide everything and choose everything in the light of this relationship, because nothing is more, no other human loyalty is more important than this. That's what we're promising in marriage. And then secondly, a moral commitment to become one flesh. Now, Bahar in Hebrew, I believe, I'm spacing out on it, but the Hebrew word and the Greek word basically seem to have the same kind of meaning. Namely, they start from the idea that the stuff that hangs on my, the meat that hangs on my bones is this stuff, flesh. From there, it gets extended to talk about an existence where I have this meat hanging on these bones, that is my present physical existence, my material existence in this world, or anything that kind of is associated with my physical material existence in this world. So a flesh can mean an individual existence in the here and now is a flesh. So in the Noah account, God came to destroy all flesh, all human beings, all human persons who were given material existence in the here and now, and God was going to destroy them all. I think the sense in which it's one flesh here is as a kind of symbol or a metaphor for what we would call a human existence. You are going to join together in one human existence, not two separate human existences. You're going to join with one another in such a way that you live out and share one human existence rather than two separate human existences. I think that's what he means by becoming one flesh. So there, that has certain ramifications. That has all kinds of implications. If I'm sharing an existence, then that means I have to make all kinds of sacrifices. I have to share. You know, I share with my marriage partner. I'm not grasping after that which is mine and demanding that which is mine and demanding my own. We're in this together. And for good or for bad, we're going to share this space in life, in human existence together. That's, I think, what we're promising to do in the marriage commitment by this definition. So notice it's not, he's not saying you'll come together and become one flesh as if that's a prediction about what's going to happen. It's not a metaphysical fact. When you get married, or when you are sexually intimate with marriage, or within marriage, or there isn't anything that happens within marriage that kind of automatically and spontaneously makes your being merge with your spouse's being, and you become one being in the eyes of God, or something like that, or in the eyes of objective reality. I think that's the way people, so they sort of insinuated that when they read this verse to me back when I was in Sunday school. And I think the purpose of that was to provide an apologetic for the biblical sexual ethic. Don't you know that every time you have sex with that girl in high school, you've given a piece of yourself away? You've joined together, and now you're connected metaphysically, and now... they didn't have to say anymore, just... it's a way of making it seem like a really grave, serious thing that you're doing. Well, it is a grave and serious thing. It's a very grave and serious thing. But every commitment is a grave and serious thing. Lying is evil. Cheating is evil. Defrauding people is evil. Not keeping your promises is evil. Not doing what you said you're going to do is evil. That's the evil of much of unrighteous sexual immorality and sexual practice. It's that we are defrauding, that we are lying, that we are cheating, and not keeping our promises. But it's not metaphysical. So God doesn't have to do a metaphysical magic to heal us back. We are who we are. We always will be who we are.
Isn't there language in Corinthians about not joining yourself with a harlot?
With a prostitute, yeah. If we had time, part three was going to look at passages just like that one. I think he's talking about this passage. And he means the same thing there that Genesis means here. Don't you realize you're making a promise to her? And we'll talk about that in a second. And it's a promise you have no intention of keeping and can't keep, and we'll get there. So the marriage commitment of a man to a woman is a moral commitment to keep those promises he made or should have made. I mean, we can try to reinvent marriage and make vows that we have no intention of keeping and don't think we have to keep. I mean, we can always do that, but it's dishonest to do that. It's a moral commitment to keep those promises that he made or should have made to the woman he is marrying, to keep his promise to leave father and mother and cleave to her, and to keep his promise to become one flesh with her. Okay. So any questions on that before?
Yeah. So I think I get what you're saying. Are you saying then that becoming one flesh, that's not something that suddenly happens when you're married? It's something that you practice. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a lifetime. Exactly. It's a lifetime process. Every day I need to keep thinking in terms of, I need to behave in such a way that I am keeping my promise that I'm going to share my existence with my spouse. Yeah. And there are all kinds of marriages where they don't do that. And they drift apart and find their own track and go their own way. And they're basically roommates who are living under the same roof. There's no marriage happening. They're not keeping that promise. Okay, so the love that we find in marriage is very different from the romantic love that we often speak of and that is a part of the mythology of our culture. The love is the moral commitment to promote the well-being of another human being, which is the very definition of love in the New Testament. Almost always, whenever the Bible uses the word love, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about my commitment to the well-being of another human being. I'm going to act in such a way that I promote their well-being in whatever context that's in. Well, that's the kind of love that is really the foundation of marriage in the Bible, is that moral commitment to promote the well-being of my husband or my wife. Specifically, it's a moral commitment to promote the well-being of my spouse by keeping the promises I made to him or her. And vice to her, and vice versa. So this commitment to love one another in this way is a commitment to forge this relationship across the sexual difference between male and female. And I think that's critical to understanding the biblical concept of marriage. And you can already begin to see what a really difficult challenge marriage can be when we begin to take seriously what it is that I'm promising to do. Share the same life with someone else? I mean, we have trouble getting along with roommates in college. We're sharing the same room, but we're not sharing the same life. In the marriage relationship, you're sharing the same life with somebody. That is a tall order. That's a challenging thing. I need to learn to sacrifice, to not be selfish, to be compassionate, to be respectful, all kinds of things that don't come naturally to us. And I have to learn that within the context of this relationship. Now, that would be hard with any human being. But now make it a woman or a man. We are fundamentally alien to one another as male and female. I would argue that the difference between man and woman is more different than any other difference between human beings. Any other category differences between human beings. It's more different than ethnic differences, I think it would be easier for a man to understand somebody from another culture than it is to really fundamentally understand a woman from his own culture. Now, that's probably hyperbole, but I don't know if it's harder, but it's the same kind of challenge, because the mindset, the mentality, the psyche, the perception of the female is fundamentally different from the psyche, the mindset, the perception of the male. We just don't see life and experience life the same way. And we become really incredibly mysterious to one another. I don't know why you reacted that way. I don't know why you're looking at life that way. I don't know why you interpreted what I said that way. Because we're not experiencing ourselves the way the other is experiencing me. So marriage becomes this incredible classroom, maybe laboratory, this incredible laboratory or classroom, but this incredible classroom wherein I learn how to love. I learn how to keep a moral commitment to be faithful, to keep my promises, to not give up, to continue to grant respect, and to continue to promote the well-being of another, even when it gets hard, even when I don't even know how to understand what's going on here. And I think that's the purpose of marriage. So the male-female part of it is a critical part of what I would take to be the purpose of marriage. It's intended to be difficult. It's intended to be a tall order to be able to pull this off. I think the sexual difference is so, I've said this before, but I think I'm beginning to think that the difference between male and female is so foundational to what God is doing that it wouldn't surprise me if that's eternal, that males will be eternally males and females will be eternally females. Not anatomically, because I think we become sexless physiologically, but psychically, I think maleness will remain maleness and femaleness will remain femaleness. I'm just speculating. I don't know that, but in light of everything that I read in the Bible, that would make perfectly good sense that that would be the case. So as I said, the difference between the sexes is what makes marriage particularly challenging. Two human beings are fundamentally very different are committed to sharing one human existence. Such a promise cannot be kept apart from a moral commitment to love one another across and in spite of a significant difference between the marriage partners. The marriage commitment is a commitment to love one spouse by making a special commitment to his spouse to make him or her the most special person in his or her life. So by its very nature then, it's going to be monogamous by the Bible's definition of that. You can't make more than one person the most special person in your life to whom you extend the highest possible human loyalty above and beyond everyone else. Only one person can be put in that position. And I think when we define marriage that way, it holds out the potential to satisfy a really deep fundamental longing of the human heart that everyone experiences. And that is to be someone, to be important, to be visible, to not be invisible, to not be a nothing. Because there's this person in my life whose whole life is centered on our relationship. And I am important to them. I am significant to them. And that's a wonderful gift that my spouse is giving me. When all else is against me, when all else is going wrong, when all else is bad, they're on my side, and they are for me, and they are committed to me through thick or through thin. They're going to be there. They've promised, and to the extent that they proved themselves faithful to that promise, they're going to remain faithful to that promise. And that there's something that has to be very psychologically satisfying about knowing that I mean something to my husband or my wife. I mean something to them. I'm not nothing. That I think that's what the Genesis account says when he created woman, or before he created woman for Adam, remember he said, it's not good for man to be alone. So why was Eve given to Adam? So that he wouldn't be alone. And I think we don't really understand the profound point that he's making until we realize that what he gave him was a wife, not a roommate or a planet sharer, you know, somebody else to be on the planet that he can talk to. No, it was a wife. that she would, it was a certain kind of aloneness that got met by a certain kind of companionship, not just companionship, but commitment, someone to be committed to it. So that marriage commitment is unique, as I've said. It's a commitment to only that one person, mutually, back and forth, vice versa. No other, it couldn't be more than one and still be marriage, still be the most significant person in my life. Fourth aspect of marriage in the Bible, the marriage commitment is enduring. It's lifelong. That's how Jesus interprets it in that Matthew account that we read. What God has put together, let no man put asunder. Let no man break it up. This is intended to be a permanent relationship over the course of a lifetime. Why? Again, I think it's because it's reflective of something very, very deep and profound about God. God's chesed, his undying loyalty to his promises, his undying commitment to keep his promises. We're supposed to imitate the chesed of God, that no matter what happens, no matter how it goes, I will hang in there because that's what God is doing in relationship to us. That's a part of his righteousness. That's a profound part of his mercy and his goodness. And we are to reflect that element, that aspect of his mercy and his goodness. His righteousness is to be our righteousness. Now, it takes two to be married. It takes two to have a relationship between God and the people of God. And the people of God throughout all of human history have spurned God and rejected him. And God couldn't pull off by himself faithfulness to them and have that relationship that he purposed for them to be their God and they would be his people. They've got to respond. If they don't respond, there's no fulfillment of that promise. Same is true in marriage. It takes two to be married. I can be faithful till I'm blue in the face. If the other person is not faithful back, there's no marriage. And that's what Jesus was getting at. So why did Moses give instructions to issue a certificate of divorce? Because of the hardness of the human heart. Because some human beings don't keep their promise. And when a human being doesn't keep the promise, if my spouse doesn't keep the promise, there's nothing I can do about that. They're not there to be married. And a divorce certificate that Moses instructed them to issue was a kind of death certificate. This thing has died. Is it my fault or the other person's fault? We can always ask the question, what role did I play? We can always ask the question, where did my sinfulness come into it? But we're all sinners. I mean, of course we all contributed, but the more important issue is, was I willing to reflect the dogged, undying loyalty of God by being doggedly loyal to my commitment and to keep my promise? And if not, okay. Then that's what I needed to repent of. I have to repent of that. We can talk about divorce if you want to. That's not really my purpose to get into that. But I think divorce has been greatly misunderstood in evangelical culture. I mean, we just take it as a kind of, if you get a divorce, then too bad for you. You now become a second-class citizen, go to the back of the bus, and you'll never be able to recover. That's just nonsense. All of us are recovering from that sin we needed to repent of. So even if I was to blame, okay, I pick up and I start over and I go from here. That's true of every sin that anybody has ever committed any time in human history. Divorce is no different than that. And finally, with respect to marriage, the nature of the marriage commitment as the Bible understands it does not become inward and us-centered. It becomes outward and other-centered. It's man and wife, husband and wife are partnering together to live a life together, to live an existence together. And what is that existence all about? It's all about loving and serving and pursuing goodness and pursuing righteousness together. So what it is that we're committing to is going to take us to, it's going to take us to others to love them and serve them, not isolate us from others. To enjoy ourselves and let you go hang. Notice how different that is from romantic love. Romantic love closes itself in. Romantic love is to become absorbed in the love of my lover. Is to bask in the pleasure that comes from being in love and therefore being in the presence of the other and so on. Wonderful feeling, awful feeling. I mean, both a wonderful and an awful feeling. An intense emotional feeling has nothing in the end to do with marriage other than to maybe get us interested. But it can't last as the foundation of a marriage. The foundation of a marriage is to make a lifelong commitment to share an existence with that man or that woman. And in doing that, we are making a commitment to do our existence the way God would want us to have to do that existence. To pursue righteousness, to pursue goodness, to pursue love and service of other people. So we become other-oriented. Particularly, that becomes particularly apt when those other people are the little ones that we bring into the world through this marriage. We're bringing whole new creatures into the world, and together now we are focusing our attention on training, educating, nurturing, protecting this new little one that we're bringing into the world. What better environment for a human being to grow up in than an environment where a man and woman are sharing together their existence and loving each other, committed to each other, and are committed to the same things, to serving other people. And right now, you are the one I'm serving. You little crying baby who won't let me do otherwise, you know. Note that romantic love does not include children, it excludes them. Years and years and years ago, there was a book written by a couple, Severe Mercy? Yeah, Severe Mercy, where they basically decided to have this relationship where they were everything to one another. Clearly a very romantic love vision of marriage. And part of their calculation was, so we can't have children. I mean, they literally shared everything. If one read a book, the other one had to read a book so they could talk about it. If one had an experience, the other had to have the experience so they could share it and could talk about it. So they literally did everything together. And since the man could not share the experience of childbirth, they decided that that was off limits and that there weren't going to be children in this relationship. The children would disrupt it, which I think, I mean, they're right. In terms of the romantic vision for love, that's exactly right. There's no room for children there. But there's got to be something wrong with that as the foundation of a relationship then. Because clearly the biblical view was that whatever this marriage relationship is, it is structured, it's designed, it's purposed to bring other human beings into it and nurture them. Okay, so married people who are practicing and experiencing marital, moral love become partners in loving others. They will not be a couple that closes itself off to others in order to become absorbed with one another. Note that romantic love and the coupling that it produces is the very antithesis of this, I think. Just a little bit on romantic love. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but with the possible exception of Song of Solomon, which I don't have a clue what it means or what it's doing there. Not really. But with the possible exception of Song of Solomon, you'd be hard-pressed to find anywhere in the Bible that even acknowledges the existence of romantic love, which is really interesting, given what a big deal it is in our culture. So the love that is foundational to the marriage relationship is not what we feel about another human being, not my emotional connection to the other human being. It's what we choose to do in relation to another human being. Now, will feelings and emotional connection follow from that? Absolutely, certainly. I mean, in a healthy marriage, you delight in each other. There's no question about that. Absolutely delight in one another. But the point is, I'm not married to you, I'm not committed to you because I find you delightful. I'm married to you and committed to you because I'm married to you and committed to you and I made a promise, I made a vow. And what kind of person would I be if I didn't keep my promise and my vow? And if I'm having a hard time feeling it right now, tough. I still have a promise to keep, so work at it. Work at keeping that promise. Out of those choices is going to come the kind of emotional connection that older people have. It's very interesting to watch my parents. They're going on their 76th wedding anniversary. I mean, you couldn't be more connected than they are emotionally. They are everything to each other. But that's not where it starts, that's where it ends. It ends after a history of being faithful, working, sacrificing, forgiving, loving, and so on. Now, romantic love is a very real phenomenon. I can't question that for a second. but from the perspective of the Bible and the biblical worldview, it has no particularly significant bearing on marriage or on the marriage commitment or on or even on the choice of whom to marry. Notice that it's only in modern times that romantic love has become the basis for marriage and human relationships. It's a fairly new phenomenon. Certainly has no bearing on sexual behavior. I mean, in the mythology of our age, if you're in love with somebody, you should have sex with them. I mean, no duh. That having sex with somebody is just the next natural step of, after being in love with them. No, not from a biblical worldview, not in the biblical perspective. Doesn't really have any significant bearing on anything that pertains to sex or marriage, except, and I don't have this in my notes, I think the role that it does play for people is the scary proposition of making a lifetime commitment to do this hard thing. Sometimes they need a little push to be willing to make that commitment. And I think romantic love can play that role. It's this natural, God-given, organic drug that drugs us out of our ever-loving minds so that we will take the step of making this commitment that otherwise we might be scared to death to make. So I think it might play that role. But everyone knows if you get married out of romantic love, it doesn't take long for it to just evaporate. It goes away. It's gone. And it doesn't remain. So now what? What's going to sustain the relationship when the eros, the romantic love, the infatuation is gone? Now what's going to sustain the relationship? That's the real foundation of marriage. And I think it's this other kind of love, this moral commitment that we make. Okay, so now that's marriage, and I think sex was made for marriage. So what do I mean by that? Here I think is the God-given design of sex. There are certainly three important elements to it. Pleasure is one of them. God made sex to be pleasurable. He designed it that way, but I'm going to argue pleasure is not the primary purpose, nor even an essential purpose of marriage. Sex would not have to be pleasurable to fulfill the role that it has in marriage as God intended it. It's hard for us to imagine separating them, but think abstractly with me here. Even if it weren't pleasurable, it would still be intimate. And it's that intimacy that is really operating to have it play the role that it's playing. It's not really the pleasure that's playing that role.
Are you up for questions?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Or, I'm actually wanting to make a statement. Are you up for that?
Sure.
I feel really incomplete with the marriage part.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Go to the sexual part.
Okay.
Although I appreciate all the points that you've made here, and mm-hmm. So I think jumping off the romantic part might be the easiest way to say this. Romantic love seems, you've talked about it before, as a drug.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning of marriage, that makes us do this silly thing, like commit our lives to another person, thinking that actually this could work because we're so in love with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of a true component.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciated your amplification of romantic love as something that first you said it was just for that beginning thing, and then you talked. It sounded very either or, like either we. Really, romantic love doesn't have any place except in the beginning, and that's all. And I hear you say that really it is the end of a relationship where that is amplified and it's beautiful.
I wouldn't even call that romantic love. Okay.
Go ahead. Well,
no, you
that's
go ahead.
What I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Is that there is this bounty of soul.
Mm-hmm.
That we gain over time, very much through the suffering of life,
mm-hmm.
suffering with each other, with having children, with being in the world, with making decisions, with figuring out what failures we are, how broken we are.
Mm-hmm.
We build soul,
mm-hmm.
and that is the connection of marriage.
Yeah.
We can join that soulishness together,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes the maturity of romantic love, just in the sense that that part of it also has joy.
Right, right.
And that's a much deeper and abiding joy. And I think that connects with, I don't know what you're going to say with the sexual part yet, but that seems to be the most important connection
yeah.
that we have
with each other, that soul connection, and it's reflected in our sexual connection, which becomes vitally different
right.
than sexuality at the beginning of a marriage.
Right.
It becomes like the most fullness, the most sacred of human connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Thank you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would make a distinction between what I, and maybe it's semantics here, but romantic love is something very different than the joy that is a profound outgrowth of relationship. That, I mean, notice from our earliest experiences of romantic love, when you're in love with a fantasy, not the actual person. When you're married and experiencing the joy of that connection, it's actually the real person that you're connected with, and the joy that comes from knowing them and sharing a life with them and so on.
And
so I'd make a big difference between those two.
Yes, I appreciate that. But often also deciding, when I know this person, will I love them?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear all that. Say that again.
When I know this person, will I love them?
Uh-huh.
Becomes the question of marriage.
Exactly.
And it is that question that I think has to be answered not once, but many times, as we disappoint and hurt each other. And that's where the soul comes in, because mm-hmm. I've decided to forgive what might seem to me unforgivable,
mm-hmm.
and to find grace from that person toward me, and me toward them, in the deepest ways that reflects something that feels more than me,
mm-hmm.
that is more than me, that mm-hmm. is a gift of grace, that I could stay with God from his gift, that I could stay with this person through his gift, because he's changed my soul.
Mm-hmm.
You with me?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And that to me is marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
And they live together.
They're interconnected, exactly. Yeah. And what's critical to biblical sexual ethics is keeping that connection between sex and relationship. I think that's key.
But it's keeping that connection, not because I'm working at keeping that connection, but I'm working at being that kind of person
right.
who can have compassion or empathy or grace for another person and for myself when we don't.
Exactly.
We don't earn it.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. Anything else before we go on to sex?
I was just going to say that it's so different from the cultural view. Because I've heard people say they fall out of love, they fall in love, they fall out of love, and if they're not having, and I think for them the connection is all sexual, and if they're not having good sex, then something's wrong with the marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like what you're saying is that what's most important in a marriage is the biblical worldview, that you guys, that like two people have the same vision, spiritually equally yoked to her certain level. But
mm-hmm. And their commitment to that, they're acting on that.
So that is the most important thing. And then I was wondering, it almost seems like you could be saying that you really wouldn't even have to, you know, like you could actually live in India and have your parents like select your husband and wife. And that would be almost better than some of the marriages that are happening now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is based on a similar worldview, you know, hopefully like a spiritual worldview, and this connection to a promise, than just on a, you know, Disney fantasy of mm-hmm. A romantic love.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do think that one thing that we have done in the West right is to make it an individual choice that I make, rather than have my parents make it for me, and because that's subject to all kinds of problems and abuse and so on. So, and because it is a moral commitment, the only person who can really make a moral commitment is me. My parents can't make it.
Yeah, but it is.
So the best I could do in an arranged marriage is they arrange the marriage, and then I decide, what am I going to do with this? Am I going to make a marriage commitment to make it? I mean, am I going to make a commitment to make it work or not? And that's what one should do. But as an institution, it's better to let... to acknowledge right up front, I need to make a commitment.
Right, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't seem to do well, Jeff.
Well, yeah.
So I'm not sure why you're saying this is good about Western culture. So far it ain't working so well.
Well, what's not good about Western culture are Western people. People are not faithful. People are not moral. People are not committed. People, we fail. The hardness of the human heart can wreck anything and everything. Okay, so pleasure is not the primary purpose of sex, nor even an essential purpose of sex. So, notice that in Genesis it doesn't say, therefore a man shall... God, in the beginning God created them male and female, therefore a man shall get together with a woman and discover what it means to have a really good time. This is not what he says. He doesn't say that's fundamentally why God created male and female, is so they could make pleasure together. As pleasurable as it might be, that's not its purpose. It's not the point. Same thing with procreation. Procreation is a wonderful miracle, and God designed sex for procreation, but it's not the primary purpose of marriage, and it's not even the essential purpose. Again, he doesn't say God made them male and female, therefore a man shall get together with a woman and make children. Doesn't say that. Now, granted, earlier he had said be fruitful and multiply in another context, and he expects that, and that's part of what marriage is all about. But when he's defining marriage, he doesn't define it around the center of procreation. As much as, Roman Catholics have done a lot of really good thinking about sexuality, but the one thing that they insist on that just doesn't make sense to me is making procreation definitive of what marriage should be. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's the way to read Genesis. It's important, but it's not central. It's not fundamental. It's not definitive of what makes marriage marriage and the very purpose of marriage. Rather, I would argue that it's communication through physical sexual intimacy and physical contact. It's the communication that happens in the act of marriage. That's its purpose. What is the essence of marriage? A commitment that we've made to one another, a relationship that we are promising to forge together. The stuff that Christine was talking about. We're going to share this life together and grow together through our experiences together. That's what marriage is. That's what we're promising. That's the heart and soul and essence of marriage. What role does sex play? Sex can express that and reflect that and enhance that and strengthen that. So if it weren't for marriage, sex would not be what it is. Human sexuality would not be what it is. A language that allows me to say to my spouse, I've promised you my life. I've promised to share my everything with you. I've promised to make you special. All of that's being communicated through sexual intimacy. Sexual intimacy is fundamentally an intimate knowledge given to one another. A husband knows his wife is the idiom that the Hebrews use. A husband knows his wife. That means knows there is a little misleading. Knows is basically a synonym for what we would call choose. When God knew Israel, doesn't mean, oh, I recognize you. I know who you are. It's God chose them for his people. That's God knowing Israel. Adam knowing his wife Eve is Adam choosing his wife Eve, I think, more fundamentally. It's where I draw something or someone into an intimate connection with myself. I pick them out to become intimate with them. That's to know them. So sexual intimacy doesn't automatically lead to knowledge of one another. That's not what that idiom is saying. It's when I choose to be intimate, I'm choosing to make you special in relationship to me. Make you more closely intimate than I would other people. All that's to say then, sex is a kind of natural language that God has given us. It has an inherent God-given meaning. To be sexually intimate someone just is to promise all of me and all that is mine to the person I'm being intimate with. It just is to say to the other person, you are special to me. And try as we might, we can try to say to, so in the movies, the two people meet in the bar, a man and a woman meet in a bar, and they decide, I just want to have sex. I just want to have a little escape and a little pleasure tonight. Can we go have sex together and agree together ahead of time that it doesn't mean anything? It's just sex. not relationship, it's just sex, right? We can tell each other all we want that that's what we're doing, but then we feel betrayed when the person that I just have sex with walks away from me. Why? We agreed together that wasn't going to mean anything, so why am I feeling this way? I mean, we get mystified by it. The reason we feel that way is because I may have said with my mouth, this doesn't mean anything, but with my body, I said exactly the opposite. I made a promise with my body. I promised my very life. I promised a commitment to be special. And if we reserve that to marriage, then it has the potential to making my marriage partner uniquely a unique person in my life. No one else do I say this to. No one else do I make this promise to with my body. Okay. Now, I think that's a built-in to the human psyche. And that's the inherent objective meaning of sexual intimacy, whether I like it or not. That just is what it means, I think.
You don't think that you can sear your conscience?
Yes. At this point? Yes. I do think we can so brutalize our psyche that we kind of don't feel it anymore and we don't recognize the meaning of it anymore. But what an achievement. Oh, I think so. But see, whereas our culture might, and I mean, I'd be facetious, but our culture might see that as some kind of wonderful freedom that we've gained. Well, a lobotomy will make you free too. But really? What kind of freedom are we getting when we have to brutalize the God-given psyche that He's given us in order to be free, to be promiscuous, to be free to be casual, to be free to not be tortured by what my sexual intimacy means? The cost is just way too great. But yeah, I think you're right. I think we can sear our conscience. Okay. So, its meaning and significance through the language of one's body. Sexual intimacy expresses the marital commitment. It makes the promises of a husband and wife to one another. So, what's its purpose? With respect to the marriage commitment that a man and woman make to one another, it, being sex, sexual intimacy, expresses the promises of a man and woman to one another in a manner such that through sexual intimacy, they celebrate that commitment, they ratify that commitment, and they reinforce and strengthen that mutual commitment. And I think that's the purpose of sex. Procreation, while it's one of the purposes of sex, it's not the only purpose, and it's not even the first and most important purpose of sex. Notice that in animal sexuality, I mean, I'm not a biologist, so I don't know how much this is true, but for a lot of animals that you can think of, they're not even interested in the physiological act of copulation if the female is not fertile. Animal sexuality is about reproduction, pure and simple. Notice that human beings don't seem to lose their interest just because of not during the fertile part of the cycle. It seems to play a different role in human sexuality. It's for a different reason. It's for a different purpose. On the other hand, God's design clearly integrates human sexuality with procreation. God's purpose involves new human beings being nurtured in exactly the environment of mutual love and commitment that the marriage commitment was designed to create. And all of us who have experienced that kind of environment from our parents just appreciate the incredible legacy that they gave us by providing that environment for us to grow up in and be nurtured in. So it's wrong to try to separate what God has put together altogether. So to separate sex from procreation altogether is to rebel against God's design. He intended procreation to be the outcome of sexuality, and so for us to kind of take that apart is an act of rebellion. That's where Roman Catholic theology, I think, is right. They have a problem with birth control out of I think those kinds of instincts. That aren't you trying to take apart what God put together? The problem is, I think they go too far because they make reproduction the only thing sex is about in marriage. And I think in that regard, they don't draw the line in exactly the places that I would draw the line. Birth control is one thing if you're seeking to control reproduction. if you're seeking to rebel against God's purposes and eliminate reproduction altogether because you don't want sex to have anything to do with reproduction, and that really is your heart attitude, then there's something wrong there. And notice, as a culture, that's exactly what we've done. That we should be free to have sex without any concern whatsoever with reproduction. Those shouldn't even be in the same category. Well, that's just sheer rebellion to think that God is wrong about that. That in putting those together, God made a mistake.
Mm-hmm. So, can you just define, maybe this is the very beginning, but you keep saying, you know, sex and marriage, sex and marriage, sex and marriage. So what are you defining as sex and marriage?
Sex in marriage is the same thing as sex outside of marriage, is any kind of sexual intimacy. I don't know that I have time to explore all the ins and outs of that, but anything that if I did it with another woman would make my spouse jealous is sex.
Are you including masturbation? Sorry, I bring this up, but I'm just wondering if some people think sex is only intercourse.
Right, it's more than, it's not only intercourse. Okay. No, exactly. Yeah?
I was just going to say, you just talked about birth control on page 4, and that it's a perversion of sorts to kind of rebel against having children all together.
Mm-hmm.
But with the culture the way it is, do you think it's possible that God might now say, well, maybe that's a good thing?
Yeah, perhaps. The key word is rebel. Because that's at the heart of what makes sin sin, is that act of rebellion. If you have people, I mean, notice, it's also God's intention to have people be married. That's sort of typical. But notice Jesus himself said that sometimes people are a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Jesus apparently, I mean, at least until recently, we didn't think he got married. Jesus didn't get married because he had a mission, and his obedience to God was of such a nature that it just wasn't. You can't be a good husband and go to the cross to die for the sins of the world at the same time. So because his mission precluded him really keeping his obligation and his promises to a wife, he didn't have a wife. Paul seems to have done the same thing. Some people argue that he might have been married earlier in his life, and that there are reason to think that maybe his wife left him when he became a believer, this crazy Jesus freak guy, and she left him for that. Well, he remained single after that. He didn't get, why? Because he had a mission. And they just, marriage and his mission weren't going to work. That's not to rebel against God's design. That's to see that my special circumstances are of such a nature that I'm making a decision here that the right way for me to serve God is to forego marriage. Could you do the same thing with having children? I don't see why not. That certain special circumstances, I might take a look at my circumstances and go, I just don't think this is what I need. I don't think this would be right. But that's not rebellion. That's trying to figure out my place in the world and God's purposes and God's scheme and so on.
In the whole section, the God-given design of sex, I know that you said in the first couple weeks or so that you can't base stuff like this on specific proof texts or like one verse,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that you have to understand holistically the message of the Bible and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I get that, but like, give me something to go on here.
I'm sorry.
Give me something to go on here. Like, where are you getting all of this?
All of this? Well, that's why I wish a lot of this is from 1 Corinthians 7, I think it is, the passage that John alluded to earlier, the way Paul applies it, and we'd have to look at it in depth. But I'm going on various texts, especially the vision of marriage in Genesis 1 and what that's all about, and granted my experience as well. I'm kind of gaining insights from all of those things and weaving my understanding of a theory out of that. Sure, please.
Again, I appreciate what you said, but I want to add.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, hear me out here, that being sexual is kind of the essence of beauty. It's like the blooming of the goodness of the soul connection that we were talking about earlier. It seems like it's reflected in beauty in a marriage in a similar way that nature is reflective of beauty on the earth. It's beautiful and it's expressive, and pleasure is part of that beauty and is integrated into it. It can be separate from it, but I think has the fullest expression of beauty as it includes that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd also say that although a husband knows his wife, although that is not the biblical meaning, it's choosing, it does seem to me that since a man and a woman are so different from one another, that a way to understand and know the difference in a very concrete and tangible way is to understand it physically, because our bodies are different, what we need is different, mm-hmm. how we give to each other must be very different. And I think not only do I know the person, but I figure out how to love them in a non-verbal kind of deep way where I learn to give.
Mm-hmm.
That matches perhaps other kinds of giving,
mm-hmm.
but it is, I think that is another place for it, all in the context of that almost sacredness that comes over years and years of marriage, where the emotional and the sexual come together. And that's what I mean by blooming into something that its essence is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that's a masterpiece. That's a gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no quarrel. I mean, notice I had all three of those elements as part of what sex is, and God has put them together. Now, what if for one reason or another one of them is missing? What would remove the very purpose of sex? It would be the communication. If there's no communication, then if there's not intimacy at all, then that has not been expressed and communicated. So what God intended to go together may, for any number of reasons, not be able to be there in every case. So a flower can grow a blossom. If the blossom gets knocked off, okay, there's no blossom. That's the beauty that God created that flower for. But it's still the flower. It's still alive. It's still vital. The flower's not necessary to the life and vitality of the being of the plant. But in the ideal world that God would create, it was intended to give rise to that beautiful blossom. So,
depending on how you define what Sherry asked, what is sex? Because if sex goes way beyond even our ability to have sexual intimacy in a typical way, say sexual intercourse, or even there is a sexuality of even my attitude to another person, that essence that I give to another person, and that is the bloom.
Right. No, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Quickly then, biblical sexual ethics, number 5. Biblical sexual ethics derives entirely from the nature and purpose of sexuality and sexual intimacy as God designed it and purposed it. What is in keeping with God's design and purpose is righteous, moral, and permissible. What is not in keeping with God's design and purpose is unrighteous, immoral, and impermissible. So sexual purity, I would argue, is basically nothing more, nothing less than acting in keeping with and desiring only that which is consistent with God's design and purpose for sexuality. And that's true inside of marriage as well as outside of marriage. I mean, sexual impurity can happen anywhere. As we'll see, becoming married doesn't just automatically make all sexual practices pure and right. It is unrighteous to behave sexually in any manner that is inconsistent with God-given purposes of sexual intimacy, and it's unrighteous to desire to behave sexually in any manner that's inconsistent with God-given purposes. So to lust after a woman in your heart is morally just as degraded as if I were to commit adultery itself. So even desiring that which is outside of God's purposes shows that there's something wrong with me. So then we have basically three different categories, I think, of sexual sins in the Bible. And some behaviors overlap these categories. They're wrong for more than one reason. So sexual sins overlap the following categories, often as sexual behavior is immoral for more than one reason. The first one is sexual behavior that defrauds another person is unrighteous. Adultery defrauds another person. It defrauds the person I'm committing adultery with. It defrauds the spouse of the person that I'm committing adultery with. And it defrauds my own spouse if I'm married. It's just a big, huge fraud going on. In Romans 13:9, you might notice that adultery is seen as violating the command to love your neighbor. So that's the, I think it's more than that. It's immoral for other reasons as well. But the one that Paul pinpoints in Romans 13 is, I'm not obeying the command to love my neighbor when I commit adultery. Fornication, and by fornication I mean any sexual intimacy outside the marriage, the context of a marriage commitment. So casual sex, premarital sex, where I haven't made a promise to the other person. I don't know if I'm going to keep this promise to the other person, but let's just have sex together. Any kind of sex outside of the context of that commitment to each other is fornication. And by that, I don't mean just sexual intercourse. I mean anything that is sexually intimate in its nature. And what can be sexually intimate? I mean, this comes back to what Christine was saying. She was talking about in the context of a relationship. But even outside the context of a relationship, sex is 90-some percent a head trip. It's not what's happening to my body. It's what I'm thinking up here. And basically, people can have sex with each other mentally. And I think that's still fornication. Even if we don't touch each other, it's still fornication. I'm having sex with the other person. This really came home to me. Okay, this is back in the height of the 60s and Vietnam and the anti-war and the weathermen, the underground. I was hitchhiking from Oregon to California and got picked up by some, basically what I finally figured out must have been gun runners. Maybe it was drugs. But they had this station wagon and there were three people sitting in the front seat, and then the back seat was basically all flattened out and built when there was a mattress. And I'm sure there was something in the compartment underneath the platform that the mattress was on. Guns, drugs, something. First thing he said to me is, if you've got any drugs, man, deny it. And we get stopped, deny it. Right? Well, so I'm really tired. So they put me in the back and I fall asleep. But in the middle of the night, we're driving through the night. In the middle of the night, I kind of wake up and the guy is driving. There's a woman sitting next to him, and she's telling about all of her work for the revolution. The work that she's doing for the revolution is basically to function as a prostitute, where she prostitutes herself to these wealthy Seattle people and makes money to buy the weapons, the guns, whatever, you know, for the cause. And the guy starts asking her about, well, so what do you do for these guys? And she begins describing, you know, the sexual behaviors and so on and so forth. I didn't hear the whole thing because I'm in and out of sleep. But as you can imagine, it's not a whole lot later that the car stops. Hey, dude, get out. You go sit in the front seat. And they proceed to occupy the mattress in the back and practice what they've been talking about. Well, words are foreplay. Words are getting my mind in gear to start thinking in terms of sexuality, sexual practices, and so on. They were already having sex in the front seat before they ever got in the back. And so fornication, I think, is anything that where I am being intimate with another person, if not physically, verbally, psychically, emotionally, whatever. We're just messing with one another's minds to orient ourselves toward thinking of being intimate with each other. Okay, so that's defrauding. And why is it defrauding? Because by its very nature, sexual intimacy is what committed people do. And by its very nature, to offer intimacy to you is to offer you my life. It's to offer you my being. It's to promise you all that I am and everything that I am. And if I have no intention of giving you all that I am and all that I have and everything I am, then I'm lying. And in order to understand the biblical sexual ethics, we have to understand what a grave offense lying is. I mean, I suppose in a culture of liars, that doesn't sound like a big deal. But in it, from a biblical ethic, lying is a huge, huge transgression of the connection with other human beings. To violate that trust, to take advantage of other people's trust in that way, is a huge act of treachery and unrighteousness. And sex is one more way to lie to people in a very grave sort of way. Okay? Second way in which we can violate what sex's purpose is, for lack of a word, perversion. That is where I distort, I twist the nature of my sexuality. That's unrighteous to do that. One of the ways we do that is through what Paul calls asulgeia, which they translate it often sensuality. Whether that's the best translation, I don't know, but I do think I understand what he means by that. It's a twisting of my sexuality to emphasize that which is not most important, namely pleasure. If I make that the priority, then I have twisted what sexuality is. And one of the ways that we do that is we then turn sex into a kind of drug. The adrenaline, the whole rush of sexual arousal and stuff like that becomes so important to me that I want it, and I get addicted to it, and I get obsessed with it. So casual sex, pornography, sexual obsession, sexual addiction are all forms of sensuality where I have placed the priority on sex simply as pleasure. Notice, I mean, take pornography, for example. There's no relationship there. Certainly there's no relationship between me and the people I'm viewing engaged in sex or talking about sex or whatever. And male and female bodies are interchangeable. When it comes to pleasure, it doesn't matter what female body, I can still have pleasure. Now, that's not to deny the point that Christine was making earlier, that we can get to know each other intimately. That's true. I mean, because we're unique and we're individuals. But if all I want is pleasure, there must be all kinds of different ways to find pleasure with another human being. You engaging in sexual behavior. That's not relationship. It's not even about relationship. It's not about communicating. It's not about making a commitment. It's just about pleasure. Well, that's a perversion of what sex is for, is what I'm arguing. I've taken apart an element of what God made a part of my sexuality. I've abstracted that out. I've pulled that out and made that everything. That's to twist it and to pervert it. And then finally, what I have earlier called morally disgusting sexual practices, and what I mean by that is practices that are so beyond the pale, so beyond the boundaries of what God had in mind, that they become kind of jarringly out of sync with God's purposes. Many heterosexual practices encouraged by a highly sexualized culture, which is what we live in, many of the practices that are encouraged by our highly sexualized culture and even practiced within the context of marriage, I think are a perversion of our sexuality. You know, we live in a culture now where kinky sexuality is normal sexuality. Our culture attempts to normalize it. And I think I mentioned this last week, but I've really changed my mind about this. You know, back when I was younger, the perspective was, once you get married, there basically are no boundaries on your sexual practices. There are no boundaries. Because the only thing that matters is that you are engaged in sex in the context of marriage. I don't think that's right. And I begin to see my mistake. Because the part that I wasn't seeing back then is how you can also pervert sexuality by simply overemphasizing the pleasure part and not put it in the full context of what it was intended by God to be. Sexuality was intended by God to be. And when we do that, we are again perverting it. So the quest for the ultimate orgasm is a false quest. Back to pornography for a second. I suspect that pornography is mainly escape into fantasy land, sexual fantasy land. Who are the real women out there who will engage in any and every kinky sexual practice that I might fantasize that I want? They're either women that want money or women that are so damaged by how people have victimized them that they have lost all sense of their own person as well as their sexuality and so on. They have been brutalized. They might be available to that kind of thing. But normal, psychologically, emotionally healthy women, I think, are not interested. And this is what men need to understand. Normal, healthy, emotionally healthy women are not interested in kinky sexuality. They're not interested in being just a sex object. They want to be related to. They want this to be about our relationship. So, but in our fantasy, I mean, that's I think why pornography can be in our culture is so devastating, because it normalizes something that can't possibly be normal with my wife. My wife is not interested, nor should she be. Why should she be interested in being a sex object? So of course she's not going to be interested in this, but we fantasize, but there's all these other women out there who are interested in being this for their partner. No, they're only acting like they are. They're getting paid big bucks to act like they are. So we have to get real about the degree to which what our culture is telling us is actually true education and instruction about human sexuality, and to what extent it's just telling us a bunch of myths and lies and fantasies to feed my fantasy. I'm speaking as a male here. I mean, you women are on your own. You're going to have to figure out how you are situated with respect to all this. But it just seems like pornography is such a bane on modern civilization, because it messes with the expectations that men have. And I think there are probably kinky sexual perversions that haven't even been invented yet. But just give us time, and we'll invent them. There's no limit to how much we can just completely distort, outrageously distort what we do with our sexuality. I made it. Any questions? Comments?
Well, I just think it's interesting. I don't know, it's just so hard to be in the world with all the music and the movies and everything, but I was thinking of Beyonce, and I don't know if anyone watches videos or, you know, music award shows, but it kind of strikes me because she got married to Jay-Z. I'm sure, I don't know all this stuff, but then I'm going to turn red because she just put out not very long ago a pretty provocative song, and it's been since she's been married, and it's almost like, you know, being married to Jay-Z has brought her this new sexuality, and it's almost like he has kind of, like, I wouldn't say forced her into it because she's a pretty strong woman, but it's just interesting. It's exactly what you're saying, that I think he has been, you know, trained by seeing all this stuff, and then he wants her to be involved in it, and then she has this whole song called Surfing Something, but anyway, but it's just so sexual. I mean, it's just like, wow, it's just so sexual, and it's just kind of shocking that everyone just, it's actually shocking that people aren't shocked, you know what I'm saying?
Again, notice, aren't they the richest couple in America or something like that?
I don't know.
I mean, they're way up there.
But, you know, she used to be...
Do you think there's an economic motive there?
Oh, I'm sure. But it's almost like if I were Jay-Z, okay, this is like really far-fetched, but I would want to protect my woman, you know, from being seen as this, you know, sexual object. So it's just kind of surprising to me. I'm just really surprised by it. And I shouldn't be, but I am.
Yeah.
And even the Miley Cyruses of the world were, you know, there's people that were shocked by that, but then there's people that weren't shocked because they think it's okay. But it's just, you know, even the people that are in the movie world were shocked by it. Some people were shocked by it. So it's even getting kind of more shocking. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's getting deeper because they're even like shocking people that shouldn't be shocked.
Something like Miley Cyrus. What's a surefire way to get publicity? cross another boundary. Cross another boundary. One that hasn't been crossed before. You'll get all kinds of publicity. If the name of the game is money and reputation and fame, how sincere are they? Are you actually interested in that? Is that actually fulfilling to your sexuality? Or are you doing this for the money and the fame?
But it seems like a woman would be, you know, because everyone talks about they're so liberated, but yet they're seen as a sexual object. So
Exactly.
It's such a disconnect for me.
I mean, I think if you were to go down here to the Women's Studies Department, University of Oregon, they'd have all kinds of teaching on pornography as part of feminist theory and so on. It's an incredible irony to me, because the sexuality of pornography is not female sexuality, it's male sexuality. Talk about becoming subservient. Talking about letting the man win. Pornography is it.
I know, that's why I don't get it either. These powerful women that are succumbing to all the pressure. I don't know, maybe it's not pressure, maybe it's...
Yeah.
I think they're sexually liberated, but I don't know, I don't think it's...
Yeah, it's not liberation.
Yeah, it is not liberation, but I think that's what they think.
Yeah.
And I can see the appeal in some ways, because there is something about, like, wanting people to admire you or think that you're beautiful or find you pleasing and attractive, that I think, while I agree with it, what you're saying, it does make sense to me that those kinds of things are, like, attractive things that women want, too. Like,
yeah.
What woman doesn't want people to, like, bow down before her beauty kind of thing, you know? Like, so that even though it's not her purpose and what she was made for, it does make sense to me that it would be, like, confusing for some of these women. No, this is what I really want. Like, this is legitimately what I want. I want everybody to know that I'm the most amazing woman out there.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
It's not about beauty, though. It's got nothing to do with beauty.
Well, maybe not true beauty, but I mean, the culture's perception of beauty. Yeah, it is right, like, it is what we've been in.
If I can't be beautiful, at least I can be desired.
Yeah.
So something like that, the object of desire.
Yeah. But it's funny, because I've heard that if we're talking about, Miley Cyrus, if you're talking about Beyonce or Miley Cyrus, but she's getting more and more and more into drugs and more into, she's stoned all the time. That's what I keep hearing. So I don't think it's sitting well with her.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not healthy.
She's like checking out of her own life.
Yeah.
Of her own success.
Yeah. That's tragic.
Yeah.
And we have a whole culture that reinforces all the myths and lies that egg all that stuff on.
Yeah. And she was the Christian girl. That was,
oh, really?
Oh, yeah, she was the Christian, you know, model, and her parents were Christians, and...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, when she was, what was the character she played? Hannah Montana, when she was the ABC Disney girl.
I didn't know that she claimed to be a Christian, though. Huh. Okay, thank you.